Hey, S-Gemmers, Ken Milne here. Happy New Year's. I hope everyone had a great end to 2017. We certainly did here at the S-Gem because we published season number 3 of the S-Gem as a free PDF book for you to download. We also completed a special 200th episode looking at a 200-year-old paper by Dr. Alexander Hamilton about bloodletting, camp fever, and the importance of randomization. We also celebrated 2017 as the year of females in emergency medicine, or FEMINEM. Now, this 201st episode was recorded in December with the lead author, Jeff Perry. And I just wanted to let you know, we had a wee bit of trouble with his audio. I did my best to clean it up, but don't panic. While the audio might not be perfect, the content is top quality FOMED. So here you go, S-Gem number 201. Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is December 19th, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is It's in the Way That You Use It, the Ottawa Subarachnoid Hemorrhage Rule. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Chris Carpenter. Chris is from Washington University. He's the deputy editor of Academic Emergency Medicine and faculty member of Emergency Medicine and Critical Care course. Welcome back to the S-Gem, Chris.
Always a pleasure to ponder the latest and greatest emergency medicine research with the King Skeptic.
Well, as soon as I saw this paper come across my Twitter feed, I knew you were the right guest skeptic. And this is because you wrote that fantastic systematic review and meta-analysis on diagnostic accuracy of history, physical, imaging, and LP for subarachnoid hemorrhage in that journal, Academic Emergency Medicine.
Folks, be skeptical of everything you hear, even if you hear it on the S-Gem.
Well, it was a hugely popular, and I think it's number 11 of all time in articles ever published in AEM.
Well, actually, I think at one time it went to number 9, but then the S-Gem hop pushed it out of the top 10. Thanks now, a lot, Ken.
Well, did you know that one of my goals of the S-Gem hop is to bump you out of the top 10 in the altmetric scores?
Mission accomplished.
Thank you. So this is the first episode of 2018, and I'm really excited to have the smartest guy I know and my EBM best friend, Chris Carpenter, here to do it. So Chris, give us a case.
Thanks, buddy. So let's start with a 35-year-old female who presents to your emergency department 3 hours after the onset of a severe frontal headache. She describes the headache as behind her left eye, throbbing in nature, associated nausea, but no vomiting. She tells you that as a teenager, she used to have migraine headaches, but she really can't remember having one for the last 10 years. The headache developed over an hour while at her desk, and she just sits at her job most of the time. She denies any associated loss of consciousness, neck pain, fevers, or neurodeficits. Your physical exam? Normal. Last week, your colleague missed a subarachnoid hemorrhage that was diagnosed as a ruptured cerebral aneurysm on the third ED visit. So you have this low threshold to miss the diagnosis of subarachnoid in severe headache patients.
Well, headaches represent about 2% of ED visits annually. And the severe headache patient presenting with altered mental status, a fever, or preceding head trauma usually generates sufficient concern to justify further diagnostic evaluations. Most other sudden onset headaches ultimately prove to be from a benign, non-life-threatening cause, like a migraine headache.
Yeah, causes of sudden onset headaches can include things like cough, exertion, postcoital, but can also include potentially life-threatening conditions like sinus thrombosis, vascular dissection, intracerebral hemorrhage, vasospasm, and aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Well, migraine headaches are at least 50, that's right, 50 times more common than subarachnoid hemorrhage among ED headache patients. So subarachnoid hemorrhage represents that needle in a haystack for a very common chief complaint.
Yeah, one of the experts in neuroemergencies in emergency medicine is Jonathan Edlow. In one of his papers, he estimates that subarachnoid diagnoses are missed between 12 and 53% of cases, with ED providers missing about 5% of them. Unfortunately, this is a devastating diagnosis. 1/4 of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage patients die within one day, and half of them never go back to work.
Identifying that subarachnoid hemorrhage early reduces these adverse outcomes if subsequent neurosurgical interventions like coiling or clipping occur emergently. Therefore, the possibility of an aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage must be considered in emergency department patients presenting with severe headaches. But Chris, in this era of choose wisely and preventing overdiagnosis, avoiding advanced imaging while simultaneously trying to reduce missed subarachnoid hemorrhage is a tremendous challenge.
Yeah, CT has become increasingly available for the evaluation of headache patients over the last 30 years. I remember as a first-year med student in the early 90s at Detroit Receiving, we had to go up 3 floors to get to the CT scanner in Detroit. And these early CT scanners were 4-slice, and radiologist interpretive learning curves were very steep over the last decade.
Yeah, these early CTs were imperfect. They had a sensitivity of around 90% for identifying small amounts of blood in the subarachnoid space. So textbooks, guidelines, and several generations of emergency medicine trainees advised against a CT-only approach to rule out aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Instead, subarachnoid could only be ruled out when a negative CT was followed immediately by a lumbar puncture demonstrating cerebral spinal fluid without red blood cells, or if it's been more than 12 hours since headache onset, absence of xanthochromia in that CSF.
However, in 2017, there are 3 problems with that approach, Chris. 1, contemporary CTs are far better at identifying blood in the subarachnoid space. 2, lumbar punctures frequently identify blood that is not in the subarachnoid space. In other words, it's a traumatic LP. And then the 3rd problem is CSF xanthochromium is not an accurate diagnostic test for subarachnoid hemorrhage.
In fact, test treatment thresholds based on very conservative estimates of CT and liberal estimates of CSF diagnostic accuracy indicate that the vast majority of headache patients will not benefit from a post-CT LP. In fact, the number needed to tap to get one cerebral aneurysm that you're going to intervene on that you would have missed with that CT scan is as high as 15,000.
Well, understanding the subarachnoid hemorrhage diagnostic evidence available for bedside evaluation, advanced imaging, and lumbar puncture is therefore essential. But Chris, the landscape, it's shifting.
This topic has been covered 3 times on the SGEM, including SGEM number 48, Thunderstruck, with Jeff Perry, who we're going to talk with in a minute. The bottom line, the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool is not ready for prime time to rule out low-risk patients for further investigation.
Yeah, and then we had SGEM number 134, and this was, listen to what the British doctors say about LP post-CT for subarachnoid hemorrhage. And the bottom line from that study was, one patient would be diagnosed with subarachnoid hemorrhage out of every 250 patients receiving an LP who presented to the emergency department with a headache that did not have their bleed identified on CT scan. So in this case, the number needed to tap 250.
And finally, SGEM episode 140, CT scans to rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage in non-academic settings. The bottom line of that episode, these community radiologists were just as good at reading CT scans as academic radiologists when looking for blood using a third-generation scanner. The number needed to tap in this study was 760, but the sole patient that they did identify as a missed CT subarachnoid was actually a perimesencephalic non-aneurysmal subarachnoid with a benign clinical course, no specific interventions.
Well, that's enough background information. I think we're really up to speed now. So let's get to the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's episode.
The clinical question is, can the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule reduce the number of acute headache patients that require further diagnostic evaluation for subarachnoid hemorrhage without increasing missed cases of subarachnoid?
And what's the reference?
The reference was in the November issue of Canadian Medical Association Journal. It's a validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule in patients with acute headache by Perry et al.
And let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Adults with acute or subacute headaches in the emergency department with clinical concern for subarachnoid hemorrhage.
And we'll put the exclusions in the show notes. How about the intervention?
The intervention was a prospective observational study with 6-month longitudinal follow-up. In fact, no intervention.
And the comparison?
No comparator in the study.
And how about the outcome?
Well, subarachnoid hemorrhage was defined by either one, subarachnoid blood visible on unenhanced CT based on the final radiology report, or two, visible inspection of CSF, xanthochromia, or the presence of greater than 1 times 10 to the 6 RBCs in the final tube of CSF collected with an aneurysm or AV malformation on subsequent cerebral angiography.
And this subarachnoid hemorrhage definition was agreed upon by 5 emergency physicians and a neurosurgeon, which I'm going, geez, they could get 5 emergency physicians to agree with a neurosurgeon? Well done. And this was previously used in the derivation and validation of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. But stop the podcast. Because you know what? We have Dr. Jeff Perry, the lead author of the study. Welcome back to the SGEM, Jeff.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Jeff is a senior scientist, clinical epidemiologist at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute, and an associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa.
Jeff, I got to say, between you and Ian and Christian Valancourt, Ottawa's grown the world's premier clinical decision aid research machine. How do you do it? And can I have a job?
You can certainly have a job here, Chris. We could always use great researchers, and especially ones that are interested in subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Well, you know, Ian and I have this ongoing battle royale. At least I'll refer to it as a battle royale. He probably doesn't even recognize it. But on calling these things clinical decision instruments or tools versus clinical decision rules. In my opinion, and it's a humble opinion, these are tools and they should guide our care. And you know, Ian, just calling them rules, it's tempting me to break them. But let's put that issue aside, Jeff. For right now, I want to know, how do you decide when you're developing a new instrument or tool? Do you call it Ottawa or do you call it Canadian?
That's been an ongoing debate. And initially, we started using the Ottawa clinical decision rules for the ankle, foot, knee. Then it kind of went to Canadian for C-spine and head. And then it's kind of, right now, we're doing kind of some of both. It's the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule, but we're also working on the Canadian TIA risk score. So I'm currently doing a bit of both.
So it's just to confuse the Americans then down north, south of the border, right?
Yeah, and they might use the Ottawa one because they might think it's from some place called Ottawa in the U.S.
So, Jeff, can you run through the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule again?
Certainly. So the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule, it's to be applied to patients with a new, sudden, severe, non-traumatic headache. This headache should reach maximum intensity within 1 hour. And it shouldn't be applied to patients with new neurological deficits, so either global deficits where they have diminished level of consciousness or if they have new focal deficits. It shouldn't be applied to patients with previous aneurysms, previous subarachnoid hemorrhage, or a known brain tumor, as those patients are at elevated risk, so those patients will likely need investigations regardless of any tool or rule. And it likewise shouldn't be applied to patients where they're having, the same as a previous headache where they've had multiple headaches. We define that as 3 or more previous headaches of the same character and or intensity over a period of greater than 6 months. So if you're once you're applying to these the right patients, we would suggest investigating patients if they have one or more of the following risk factors.
Now, Jeff, there's 6 components to this Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool. I really wish you could have got it down to my favorite number of 5, but okay, 6. What are the 6 things?
So the 6 items in this rule are symptom of neck pain or stiffness, age over 40 years, witness loss of consciousness, onset during exertion, if it's a thunderclap headache, so this is a headache that peaks instantly, or if they have limited neck flexion on examination.
All right, this is one of the great opportunities of having the lead author on the show. What were your actual conclusions?
We found that the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule was sensitive for identifying subarachnoid hemorrhage in otherwise alert, neurologically intact patients. We believe that the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule can be used to rule out this serious diagnosis, thereby decreasing the number of missed cases while constraining rates of neuroimaging.
All right, Jeff, you can sit back and relax for a few minutes while Chris and I go through the quality checklist for clinical decision tools. All right, Chris, first question. The study population, did it include or focused on those in the emergency department?
Absolutely. These are ED patients enrolled from 6 university-affiliated Canadian tertiary care hospitals from January 2010 to January 2014. This is a convenient sampling rather than consecutive sampling because researchers missed approximately a third of the patients because study personnel weren't there to recruit the patients. Research staff reviewed the ED logs to identify potentially eligible patients, and potentially eligible patients who were not prospectively enrolled were similar to those included in the validation analysis. That is, they analyzed the characteristics of both patient sets. The Institutional Review Board, however, only permitted telephone follow-up for the patients they consented and enrolled and who were discharged without both a CT scan and lumbar puncture, which were normal.
Question two, the patients were representative of those with the problem.
Yes.
All important predictor variables and outcomes were explicitly specified.
Yeah, if you read in the CMAJ paper, you have to go back to the original derivation studies for the definition of some of the subjective predictors, like thunderclap headache or limited neck flexion, but it's there if you look for it.
Question four, is this a prospective multi-center study including a broad spectrum of patients and clinicians, i.e. a level two study?
Not sure about that. We'll talk more in a moment about that.
Clinicians interpreted individual predictor variables and scored the clinical decision rules reliably and accurately.
Yes.
This is an impact analysis of a previously validated clinical decision tool.
No, we haven't gotten there yet.
All right. For level one studies, impact on clinical behavior and patient-centric outcomes is reported.
Yeah, so a level one study is an impact analysis, and we haven't progressed to that stage of CDR development yet.
The follow-up was sufficiently long and complete.
Yeah, I think it was long enough for ED provider purposes, but not complete.
All right, and the final question, the effect size was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant.
Yes, I believe so.
All right, let's run through those key results. They enrolled just over 1,000 patients prospectively, of whom 67, or around 6%, had confirmed subarachnoid hemorrhage. An additional 590 potentially eligible patients were not enrolled, among whom 33, or again, around 6%, had confirmed subarachnoid hemorrhage. Chris, what was the primary outcome?
Well, it was the diagnostic accuracy of the rule, the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule, and it was 100% sensitive. That is, no subarachnoid hemorrhage cases were missed, and it had 13% specificity, 13.6.
So this gave a positive likelihood ratio of 1.16 and a negative likelihood ratio of 0.
Yeah, pretest probability for subarachnoid hemorrhage of 5.8% with a negative likelihood ratio of 0 would yield a post-test probability of subarachnoid hemorrhage of 0. However, the study was slightly underpowered with an upper limit of the confidence interval for the negative likelihood ratio, by my estimation, going all the way up to 0.5, which would actually bring the post-test probability to 3%, not 0%. The true post-test probability for patients without any of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule features, i.e. a low-risk population, is somewhere between 0 and 3%, and I think it's probably much closer to 0% than 3%, but it's certainly not 0%.
Well, they did check in with the physicians on how comfortable they were with using this subarachnoid hemorrhage tool, and physicians reported being uncomfortable or very uncomfortable in using the tool in only about 9% of patients and demonstrated excellent agreement between the bedside physician and the coordinating center research nurse.
Yeah, the kappa was 0.82, which was really excellent. In 5% of cases, the physicians who interpreted the Ottawa subarachnoid rule as negative had the coordinating center actually go back and look at it and say that was actually a positive. So you could say there was a 5% false negative rate when the treating clinician applied it.
And in actuality, 88% of patients had CT imaging and another 1% had lumbar punctures without a CT. The authors hypothesize that if the rule had been used to guide CT or lumbar puncture decisions, only 84%, or about 5% fewer patients, would have undergone additional testing like a CT or LP. Well, those were the key results, Chris. Now we're going to bring Jeff back in and we're going to talk nerdy. Yes, one of my favorite sections. So, Jeff, we're going to go through five questions. Is that okay?
That sounds good.
All right, I'm going to kick it off with the first question, and this is about external validity and reproducibility. The six enrolling sites were the same hospitals, and most likely many of the same physicians, engaged in the original Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool derivation studies. Whether physicians from different geographic regions and non-academic hospitals would accept, interpret, and use this clinical decision aid on headache patients remains unproven. Emergency providers in some countries are less likely to accept clinical decision aids or apply them indiscriminately to populations in whom the rule or tool was never validated.
Yeah, so we utilized sites that did participate in the earlier phases of this study. These sites were previously strong in enrolling most eligible patients. However, in this case, for this study, we enrolled a completely new cohort of patients. And as such, because they were new cohort of patients, we don't expect any major bias. We chose these sites because it's very difficult to get sites to participate in clinical decision rule studies. Physicians are required to fill in a data form prior to investigating the patients. This takes a few minutes, and they're not paid for this. So in an era where we're facing increasing demands as emergency physicians, and in many places in Canada, we're actually getting lower pay these days than we were a few years ago, it's a tough sell to get physicians to agree to participate in an activity that they're not getting compensated for, and it, in fact, could actually lower their productivity and result in even lower compensation for their time. And in fact, yeah, we even had to drop one site because their physicians felt that they could no longer afford the time to complete our forms due to increased ED volumes and ED overcrowding issues. So while it would be ideal to go to new sites, I would certainly agree with that, it's often not possible to get high rates of enrollment so that you can be confident in the results and have them do this on a volunteer basis. And in addition, we wouldn't expect the sensitivity to vary from site to site. That should be pretty much constant, albeit that the positive predictive value and the negative predictive value could certainly change between different settings if they have a different prevalence of subarachnoid hemorrhage in their patient population.
Well, Jeff, as someone who works in the same Canadian system you work in, I can really appreciate that answer because I know how hard it is and the time pressures that we have currently. So I really appreciate that. It is one of the limitations, but I certainly understand why you did what you did.
Jeff, the second nerdy question that we wanted to ask was about precision. And your group had planned to enroll about 1,200 patients and almost got there. And you wanted to capture about 75 cases of subarachnoid hemorrhage to achieve near 100% sensitivity with acceptably tight confidence intervals. You were only able to enroll 1,153, and that was 67 cases of subarachnoid. So the study is slightly underpowered, and the confidence intervals around the likelihood ratio negative, which is the important one. We're not so concerned about the positive. The likelihood ratio negative is reported as zero, but if you do one estimation of confidence intervals, it can extend up to 0.5. And I'm wondering, did the authors conduct a sensitivity analysis to test the impact on sensitivity and negative likelihood ratio if one or more of the false negative cases of subarachnoid, or one of the cases that was missed was actually a false negative if we had recruited more patients or followed up 100% of the patients?
We didn't do a formal sensitivity analysis in this publication. We did do so in a previous the previous JAMA publication where we refined our rule and developed the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. But despite that, I'd say that we're still quite confident in our results. So while we didn't get the full 75 subarachnoid hemorrhage patients enrolled as we had planned, we did have 33 patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage who were sort of in the missed eligible group. In that group, we did apply the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule from our site coordinator, and all were clearly identified by the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. That provides us some degree of assurance that, the rule did perform well in this validation study. In addition to this, we also know that the rule applied well to the previous 132 subarachnoid hemorrhage patients from 2,131 enrolled acute headache patients in our original or previous refinement phase published in JAMA. And we also know that in the 130 subarachnoid hemorrhage from the very original derivation study in BMJ of 1,999 patients. God, I wish we had one more patient. We know that it would have applied in that group as well. So hence, we feel very confident in the results and that they are extremely close to zero as far as the likelihood negative ratio.
Okay, yeah, I'm pretty confident about this rule as well based upon the excellent methods and the prior publications.
Our third nerdy question we wanted to talk to you about was differential verification bias and loss to follow-up. A certain skeptic and legend of emergency medicine was critical of the initial derivation and validation studies based on two aspects of the study design.
First, not every enrolled patient had both CT and post-CT LP if imaging was non-diagnostic for subarachnoid hemorrhage. The IRBs wouldn't permit this ideal world approach due to the personal risks of these procedures in whom the physician did not feel were medically indicated or the patient refused. I mean, my IRB is not going to let me strap down the patient and do an LP when they say, no, no, no. So, and the cost of the healthcare system as well. We can't force test on people that don't want the test or that we don't feel are indicated and that nobody's going to pay for just for study purposes. It's just, you can't do that. So when different criteria and standards are applied to patients, differential verification bias, which is also known as double gold standard bias, is likely, and observed estimates of sensitivity and specificity can be falsely lowered for disease processes like subarachnoid hemorrhage, and when that process only becomes detectable during longitudinal follow-up.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a reality when conducting clinical research. Research ethics boards will not allow you to do some things. Physicians may not agree to do certain things, and finally, some patients will not agree to certain things. So we came up with an a priori method of assessing our patients. We certainly went through extraordinary steps to follow up patients with medical record reviews, to call patients at both 1 and 6 months. At the end of the study, verified again that they didn't have any subsequent clinical visits. And finally, we checked with the coroner's offices and checked obituaries and looked to make sure that the patients didn't die. And we definitely think that we obtained the highest level of follow-up we could. And we think that this is a reasonable method of assessing whether or not they had a subsequent subarachnoid hemorrhage. And I think that the amount of bias here is very minimal. And we think this is basically the most pragmatic way to assess for our outcome.
The second criticism was about patients that were lost to follow-up. In this study, 8 out of the just over 1,000, so that worked out to 0.6%, were lost to follow-up. How would the best case scenario, with none of those 8 having subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is probably the most likely scenario, compare with the worst case scenario where all 8 of the lost patients had a subarachnoid hemorrhage and were not found? This would affect the observed sensitivity of the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool.
Well, I agree. It certainly would affect the sensitivity. I would certainly argue that our follow-up is extremely tight. Having just 8 patients, as you mentioned, 0.6% were lost to follow-up is extremely small. And I think it's extremely unlikely that any of these patients had a missed subarachnoid hemorrhage. We used the same methodology in our previous phases and never identified any patient with a missed subarachnoid hemorrhage who did not represent to one of the enrolling hospitals. It should be noted that all of our enrolling hospitals contain their regional neurosurgical center. So certainly anybody who was diagnosed with a subarachnoid hemorrhage was almost certainly likely going to represent to one of the enrolling sites in the region. And it's also something like subarachnoid hemorrhage. It's highly likely that the enrolling group would hear about a missed case of subarachnoid hemorrhage through their hospital quality assurance programs and through patient complaints and whatnot. We feel that it's highly unlikely that any of these eight patients had a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Certainly acknowledge that it's in theory possible if they would have went for a visit down to the U.S. and died while they're on vacation. As such, we never found out about them, but we think that that's pretty unlikely.
Again, as somebody works in the same healthcare system you work in, we have a system here, and so we don't lose people that often. So that 0.6 was an impressive number.
What's a system?
Chris, you go ahead. You know, every time you make fun of us, I can go to the hospital and get my feelings checked for free.
Oh, healthcare system. What a novel concept. So, Jeff, for the fourth thing we wanted to ask you about, if you look at that knowledge translation pipeline that's on the SGM website, the bottom two leaks in the pipeline deal with the patients and the families and their buy-in. And so that means we've got to have some shared decision-making with the patient when we have important diagnostic and therapeutic decisions. And there's some debate around when clinical decision aids have sufficient validation to justify widespread uptake and to be used for the development of patient decision aids, which is different than the clinical decision aids that we use for clinical patient encounters. These are for the patient to help them understand our complex decision-making process and the different probabilities of different outcomes. So I'm wondering, is the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule sufficiently validated, in your opinion, to use as the basis to start designing patient decision aids?
Yes, Chris, we believe it is. And in fact, we have already started a process to develop a platform for this purpose. So we're using sort of computer graphics and as well as simple sort of numbers to help illustrate what the risks associated with testing or not testing are for subarachnoid hemorrhage, and also going further to help patients with the decision after having a CT scan whether or not they need to proceed to a lumbar puncture.
Yeah, I think that's going to really help with knowledge translation pipeline to make sure that patients understand why we're having this conversation and why we're having this instrument help us to make a decision in those gray zone cases.
So, yes, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that this is going to be an area where shared decision making will be very important.
Well, let's move past shared decision making and into the fifth question, which is about impact analysis. Diagnostic and prognostic tests are usually disseminated on the assumption that accuracy equates to patient-centric benefit, but without actual studies to quantify or even confirm such benefit. In an ideal world, patients would present to the emergency department and have tattooed on their forehead, "I have a subarachnoid hemorrhage," negating the need for a decision aid. But in the real world, patients present with a constellation of symptoms that clinicians need to identify, interpret, and transform into diagnoses that inform treatment options, urgency of further evaluation and consultation, and truly inform shared decision-making with patients.
And the process of transforming these signs and symptoms into clinical action, it occurs in a fishbowl of chaos in which providers are judged by various metrics, including ED flow, patient satisfaction, and test ordering rates relative to a standard imposed by someone else. Deciding whether or not to order a diagnostic test must be balanced against patient and family anxiety and their personal goals of care, as well as each physician's risk tolerance, while also considering transitions of care, including the emergency physician to whom you may be handing this patient off, and the inpatient or outpatient teams will be following them up.
Therefore, evaluating whether the subarachnoid hemorrhage tool is acceptable to providers like physicians, NPs, and PAs in non-academic settings like rural community settings where I work that are less aware and perhaps less accepting of decision aids is essential. So we're going to ask Jeff a series of five questions about the impact analysis. Jeff, do you think these practitioners will believe this validation study, or do you think they will need more validation studies before adopting this clinical decision instrument?
Yeah, Ken, I think that they will believe in that the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule is ready to use. We've now enrolled over 5,000 patients with acute headache and have shown that the rule is accurate and highly sensitive. I think even the strongest skeptics will be ready to adopt this clinical decision rule.
And Jeff, will these providers apply the rule to headache patients similar to those enrolled in the study? In other words, will they remember all these exclusion criteria and the fact that we're applying it to patients with, we're really concerned subarachnoid may be a possibility, or is it going to be used indiscriminately for every patient who walks in the door with maybe a headache?
So we certainly hope so, and we are endeavoring to make sure that all figures and apps and tools that are used to help physicians remember the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule include the inclusion and exclusion criteria right with them so that they can apply it to the right patients and they don't start using it indiscriminately.
Jeff, do you think the practitioners will be able to explain the decision aid and what it does and doesn't tell us to the patients and families?
I think this is difficult to predict right now. I think we will need to assess that and ensure that we come up with a decision aid that is able to achieve this goal. I certainly do encourage physicians to have this discussion with their patients and their families about the risks of investigations or not investigating, so that both the physician and the patient and their families are all comfortable with the decision that they make. Ultimately, I think we need a good decision aid, a tool that can be used at the bedsides by physicians or their care provider to have that conversation with the patients and the families so that there's better understanding. But until that's developed, I think the conversation should still take place now.
Jeff, Ken and I also listened to other social media voices out there, and some of them have been talking about your paper before this episode and have said, you know, if you want to CT everybody, go ahead and use this rule. And it's true that your rule identified 87% as non-low risk and perhaps benefiting from additional workup. And you hypothesized that if the rule had been applied real time, you might have decreased CT imaging by 5%. Do you think that its subsequent impact studies, like a randomized trial or a pseudo-randomized trial, are going to show in all healthcare settings and EDs a consistent decrease in ordering rates of CTs?
I think that there is a trend, and I certainly have seen this throughout our studies. When we first started these studies, the imaging rate was about in the high 80s, about 88%. Since we started this work about 18 years ago, rates have steadily gone up. So I think that while the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule won't decrease imaging much from what the current rates are at our study sites, we think that it will actually hold the line and may translate into a modest decrease, but we think that ultimate rate will be less than if there was no Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule to use. We also think that there will be a decrease in lumbar puncture use as more people are aware of the six-hour rule, where patients within 6 hours that are imaged, 6 hours of their headache onset who are imaged, won't go on to have further testing performed.
I would encourage any of the SGEM listeners who are poo-pooing that 5% reduction rate to take a look at the 2015 Academic Emergency Medicine Consensus Conference on Optimizing Imaging. I think, like Jeff said, consistently across continents, across healthcare systems, CT ordering rates have gone up, and anything that we can do to start to reduce that trend is beneficial. And this is one way to safely do that on a complex patient population, in my opinion.
All right, the fifth sub-question of the five questions. Chris, did you see how I expanded my five questions to include so many more?
I think that's cheating, Ken.
No, I just have to stick to my five. So the fifth question was, or the fifth sub-question was, what implementation strategy does the Ottawa group have for this tool, and how would they recommend implementation scientists around the world introduce and study decision aids like the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool using the STARI reporting standards?
We are planning to conduct a full implementation study as is the next step. Certainly, we will use the STARI reporting standards and look at those when we go to do so. I think that any kind of implementation is going to require multiple facets to it. We're going to need to have visual cues, ideally have real-time reminders so that when physicians are going to order tests, that some box comes up on their computer to tell them to think about the rule, or does this patient really need to have a scan based on the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. We're currently working on an app that can help physicians quickly remind themselves what the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule components are. We have the Ottawa Rules app, which will contain the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule within the next couple of months. And it's already on other apps that are available currently. So physicians are going to need to have to use multiple steps to do this. And when you do go to implement the study or its results, it's very important to make sure you figure out what the local issues are that are going to either facilitate following the rule or be barriers to following the rule. So like in this case, where at the beginning of this segment where you talk about a recent missed subarachnoid hemorrhage, well, that's going to be important to address head on because the physicians are going to be feeling very frightened of missing a subarachnoid hemorrhage in their patient population. So knowing that information is going to be critical to implementing it locally in that site.
Yeah, those missed cases always bruise our cognitive egos, make us less confident with the next few patients we see. They always linger with us a little bit. For the STAR guidelines for the SGM audience, those are the standards for reporting implementation science. And I'm sure Ken and I will be talking more about that in future episodes. But it's a worldwide stamp of approval of how to conduct and report implementation science research, just so everybody knows what those are. Ken, can I ask one more question in addition to your five sub-questions?
Well, being a polite Canadian, yes.
Good. So here in the U.S., I need to worry about things like malpractice and payment a little bit more than you guys do, because we've got a pay-for-performance type system or a pay-for-service. And so I think payers in the U.S. may be someday thinking of the Ottawa subarachnoid rule as a penalty to deny payments for clinicians who deviate from the rule and order additional tests based upon their gestalt. Jeff, do you foresee some insurance companies using it as a tool to not pay physicians someday?
I think that it's certainly quite possible that insurance companies may do that. I think that in reality, it's probably unlikely to happen. And as you've mentioned, within the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule, we don't decrease imaging rates dramatically. So I suspect that insurance companies may not penalize them. However, I think it is good clinical care to apply the subarachnoid hemorrhage rule to the appropriate patients. We believe it's going to decrease the miss rate that currently exists, which is quite low in academic centers, but known to be significantly higher in smaller and more rural centers. So we think that it will help with that, and it will help to hold the line on the ever-increasing rates of imaging with or without a sort of insurance company playing police and saying whether or not they're allowed to or will be compensated for ordering that test.
Well, those were the five nerdy questions. Jeff, this is an opportunity. Is there anything else that you want the SGEMers to know about the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool?
Yeah, so Ken, I think the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule is really the first step in the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage strategy. So with this, we want physicians to first determine which patients with an acute headache require any investigations. So apply the rule, determine who needs investigations. Then we strongly encourage them to determine, was this headache within 6 hours? If it was less than 6 hours, for most patients, they don't require any further testing. We know that the point estimate for sensitivity is 100% with fairly tight confidence bands of 97 to 100%. So for most patients, it's enough to stop there. Now, if you have somebody who has the perfect story for subarachnoid hemorrhage, they're in that 40 to 60 year range, that instant peaking headache, something that they've never had before, they have family members with subarachnoid hemorrhage, well, that patient may need to go on and get further testing. Wouldn't disagree with that. But for the vast majority of patients, the CT is sufficient as long as somebody whose experience is reading it. It should also be noted that patients who are profoundly anemic, blood will not be very well distinguished with on CT. So in that patient population, you need to use extra care. For patients that do need to go on to get further testing, we've also looked at that. So we've looked at ways to differentiate traumatic TAP versus true subarachnoid hemorrhage. And with that, we found that patients with who go on to get the DLP done, patients with greater than 2,000 times 10 to the power 6 per liter RBCs, or those with visible xanthochromia, are at high risk for aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, whereas those with less than 2,000 and no visible xanthochromia are at low risk. Therefore, again, unless you have somebody who has a very heightened pretest probability who doesn't have a completely normal CSF analysis, those patients may need to go on to get further testing. But for the most patients, you can confidently stop there. I certainly strongly encourage people not to use angiography indiscriminately on the basis that you're going to identify incidental aneurysms, and that can result in harm for patients where they go and get procedures done on incidental aneurysms that may never have caused them any problems in the first place.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for answering all of our nerdy questions. Chris, could you comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEMS?
We generally agree with the author's conclusions, with the caveat that whether similar physician acceptability, reliability, and diagnostic accuracy will be observed in non-academic, non-Canadian EDs, I think that remains to be seen. I think it will, but I think we need to prove that.
Okay, can you give us an SGEM bottom line?
The Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage tool needs external validation in other settings, a meaningful impact analysis performed, and patient acceptability of incorporating this rule into a shared decision-making instrument before I think it's going to be widely adopted in many settings.
How about a case resolution?
The patient's non-high risk by the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. After her headache resolves with intravenous prochlorperazine, you explain the differential diagnosis of headache, including subarachnoid. Your clinical gestalt is that the headache characteristics are atypical for subarachnoid and more consistent with migraine, particularly given her history as a teenager. She expresses concern about cerebral aneurysms because she's been on her smartphone and using Dr. Google while she's waiting. And you explain the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule and the fact that she has none of the high-risk criteria, and her risk of subarachnoid would probably be far less than 1% based upon what we know now. Understanding your gestalt aligns with the new Ottawa rule relieves her anxiety. She's discharged home with migraine abortive therapy, and she's to follow up with her primary care physician. 2 days later, your ED nurse conducts a routine follow-up call and reports that she's had no further headaches. She has an appointment with her primary care provider later that day, and they'll at that time evaluate whether she needs specialty referral.
So, Chris, how are we going to take this new study by Perry et al. And apply it clinically?
Well, Ken, I'm going to quote the esteemed Sir Eric Clapton. It's in the way that you use it. Decision aids are not meant to be used in cases where physicians are certain of the appropriate next steps. They're just not. That's not what Ian's team has devised them for. Instead, they're meant to guide us in that gray zone where various factors lead to significant and demonstrable practice variability. If physicians use the tool indiscriminately on patients who they never would have obtained CT before, it's going to increase CT ordering. We know that. Additional research will tell, but I think clinicians just need to use the rule for those patients in whom they have lingering uncertainty and applies to the study patients we looked at in this study.
So what are you going to tell the patient that presented with a headache?
Well, the bad news is it looks like you're having a migraine headache. The good news, we can treat it, and we just did. There's other good news, too. We considered other serious causes of your headache besides migraine. It looks like you do not have one of those other bad headaches. One thing we always worry about is a bleed in the brain could be causing a headache. One cause of this bleeding is subarachnoid hemorrhage. And there's a list of 6 things to help us decide if subarachnoid hemorrhage is likely. You have none of those 6 things. This means you have a 97 to 99% chance, probably much closer to 99%, the headache is not a brain bleed. We could do a CT scan, and we could do a lumbar puncture to bring that number closer to 100% certainty. These tests take time, though. They cost money, and they all have risks. CT involves radiation that has a small chance of causing many forms of cancer. The spinal tap can cause infection, bleeding, damage to the spinal cord, or pretty commonly make the headache worse. What are your thoughts about the next steps?
All right, it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Gareth DeBeegan, or DeBeegan,
depends on your pronunciation. Sorry, Gareth, if I got that wrong. Gareth is an assistant clinical professor at Maine's Medical Center and Tufts University School of Medicine. He knew the four humors in Latin were sanguis for blood, phlegma for phlegm, cholericus, yellow bile, and atrabilis, black bile. Chris, what's the Keener question this week?
Oh, I love this question. Which 20th century London physician first used the term spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage?
If you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there are some other FOMED resources on this publication. The Wash U Journal Club did an episode on this, St. Emlyn's blog, and EM Literature of Note. I'd like to give a conference update. Chris, both of us are going to be presenting at the Emergency Medicine and Acute Care conferences. Where are you going this year?
Ken, I'll be in Las Vegas in April, and in June I'll be in lovely San Diego.
Yeah, no, I'm going to be going to Costa Rica with Manrique Humana. It's going to be Pura Vita. And then I'm going skiing in Vail. Oh, of course, there's great CME there too, but going to Vail, and it's going to be a family holiday as well. And then I'm doing that little Mickey Mouse course over in Orlando and then finishing up in Nashville, Tennessee. Chris, Happy New Year.
Happy 2018, Ken, and everyone out there.
And thanks, Jeff, for coming back on the SGEM and putting up with me doing the rules versus tools thing through the entire episode.
Thanks for having me, Ken. It's always a pleasure to talk about the Ottawa rules.
You won't let it go. I'm just wondering, when will your group come up with one rule to rule them all? Dun, dun, dun. But until you do, can you give the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.